Hi, everybody. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration, and I want to welcome you to today's live ROI webinar, How to Use Big Data to Increase Revenues and Capture New Customers, sponsored by Infutor. Big data is top of mind for many retailers today. Why? For starters, because retailers have a plethora of big data at their fingertips, which they can use to analyze current customers as well as find new ones. And smart retailers understand how big data can create competitive advantages for them. But retailers are still struggling with how to use data correctly, and perhaps even more importantly, how to source it correctly and even legally. To find out how to collect and use big data in the best way possible, listen in today into today's lively and interactive webinar with mobile marketing expert Michael Becker, who is now the head of market development North America at Selmo, and Mary Jo Yapchak, senior vice president of product development at Infutor, as they discuss data landscape, the best sources for data, and how to use to increase revenue and capture new customers. Before we get started, however, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help button at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via Q&A box. A quick tip can be that common problems like loss of sound or stall on slides can often be fixed by a quick refresh of your browser. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Also, please make sure to turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. Speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. Okay, with that, I'm going to pass it on to Michael Becker. So take it away, Michael.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for having the opportunity to spend some time with you and talk about mobile marketing and the use of data. I'm really excited about this topic, and it's critically important for us as marketers to understand it. I'm going to move forward with a couple of the slides. And again, as we talked about in Melissa's introduction, we're going to be talking about big data. And specifically, over the next 25 minutes or so, I want to drill down on this idea of data and understand and put it within the context of our role as marketers, to put it into the context of the evolution of marketing and the various bases of competitive advantage that's emerged, and the evolution of mobile and customer behavior. And then we're going to wrap that up and really illustrate some key examples of where data can be used in, out in the wild within your marketing for you to be able to leverage and drive successful engagement for your clients and customers. So first and foremost, let's take a step back and take a look at the responsibility of marketing. What do we do as marketers? What are we supposed to be doing? Why are we supposed to be doing it? And how do we do it? So the first and foremost, what we want to be thinking about is the number one responsibility of marketers, where we start, is getting new customers. So part of the marketing job is to go out and find customers for the business. The second step is to keep them. Then we need to encourage them to spend more with us, get them to spend more often, and then through that process, build the brand. That's really the job of marketing. And increasingly over the last, say, 100 years or so, how we go about doing this has been changing dramatically, as has the basis of competition in the industry. So for the last 100 years, we've been really in a broadcast model of marketing. You know, this is the era, and really that broadcast model really started with the advent of television and took great root with the madmen of the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s. And the whole model there was to be able to push messaging out into the marketplace, out into media to engage and interact with consumers. And at that time, we didn't really need or have or necessarily data wasn't really paramount at that time in the sense of data as we see it today. Because, if you wanted to reach 80% of the women in the marketplace, you could go, advertise on one of Procter & Gamble's soap operas, and you were now reaching and having the opportunity to engage a majority of the audience. But as the market has changed, so has marketing. So when we think about that, through the 1900s to 1960s, if we take a step back and don't really focus on marketing, the way companies drove dominance in the marketplace was through manufacturing. It was about how we made as much stuff as we possibly could, as well as we could, and as cost effectively as we could. And that's where this idea of economy scale and everything we learned in our university training was about, you know, how do we build these economies to scale to make stuff? Then in the 1960s to 1990s, the basis of competition changed. It's now become the age of distribution. Now they're in the mastery of that. So now that we know how to make things, let's get them out into the market as quickly as possible. And that's really where we started to have local retail, where people were able to buy buy goods and services in their own hometown, you know, at scale in the marketplace. And then in the 1990 to 2010, a new area of competition emerged, and this was information supremacy. This is where Amazon and Google and the likes of Facebook took charge in the marketplace, where we took all of the information about the products and services that we made and that we've learned how to distribute, and now we've put them up in this thing we call the Internet. And within the Internet, we now have this ability to disseminate information at scale globally. And the distribution and manufacturing have become less of a competitive advantage because they're now commoditized. We can buy those from anywhere and everyone else. But now in 2010, something else has emerged. This idea called mobility, this idea called connectedness, the idea where we can be engaging and interacting with consumers at scale on a one-to-one basis. And the reason why that is fundamentally changing the nature of marketing and competitiveness is because it's really about now data mastery. How do we actually embrace and leverage and capture all of the data that's possible in the marketplace? And as Forrester Research tells us in a recent study that they did, this is really the new basis of competitive advantage. And so when we look at the world of data and we want to think about data out there, you know, as Mickey McManus in a wonderful book, I encourage you to go get it. It's called Trillions. Mickey McManus mentions in his book that the data no longer lives in our devices, but we rather live in the data. And, you know, the ones and zeros are swirling around us at all times and places. And this concept of how we engage and interact with people and how we interact with the data is absolutely paramount to how and where we go with the marketplace going forward. And if you don't really believe me, let's take a step and look at a quote from one of the leading marketers out there. So Sir Martin Sorrell, the CEO of the Publicis of WPP, recognizes that our competitive set is no longer Omnicom, IPG, and Publicis. It is the Nielsen and GfK. It's the data company. So the CEO of one of the largest marketing conglomerates in the world recognizes that now data is the basis of competitive advantage, and we need to learn how do we use it and where does it come from. So let's take a thought about where does it come from. It all started back in the early 1950s with the first IBM 701 electronic analytical control unit. This was a computer. They sold 19 of them, and it enabled you to start analyzing information that was out in the marketplace. But as these devices and as these computers matured and changed, so has consumer behavior. And the first step of that consumer behavioral change when it comes from the concept of mobility, was this idea of the introduction of the first Motorola phone in 1983. This was a 32-ounce brick that people carried with them. And Motorola's predictions in this really great promotional video that they have. And I'm going to make the reference now. Throughout the presentation, I'm going to be reviewing to a handful of videos that I have access to, and if you want them, shoot me an email at michael.becker@somoglobal.com, and I'll be happy to share them with you because, unfortunately, we couldn't play them at today's webinar. But it really shows how, you know, they were predicting that, you know, within a few short years, thousands of people would have these things we call the mobile device. And it's interesting to see where their prediction's coming, because if we fast forward now, you know, 30 years, we can now recognize, or 40 years, frankly, we can now recognize that the mobile phone has changed dramatically. So by 2005, let's take a look at what's going on in the marketplace. This is a fairly famous picture that's been floating around the Internet of when the Pope was elected in 2005. And if you look right down in the bottom right corner of the screen, you'll see someone taking a picture I believe that's a Motorola Razr at the time. It's a recognition of the starting of consumer behavior that we're now bringing these computing devices out into the marketplace. And then a couple years later, in 2007, something exciting happened to the world, and Apple launched the iPhone. And you now have this new generation smartphone in the hands of the world, which, in fact, if you think about it from a data and computing platform, is unsurpassed by anything that came before it. And, in fact, today's modern-day mobile devices are essentially supercomputers in the average consumer's hands. Today, the mobile phone has well over 3,000 times the processing power than the average, than it took us to send people to the moon and back. So the entire Apollo moon launch had 3,000 times less processing power than that's in the average consumer's hands. So it's really important for us to think about now that when we're engaging and interacting with consumers in the marketplace, that mobility is taking a central role in that stage. If we move forward and we think about the evolution a little bit more, we now, in 2010, the introduction of this new category of computing devices, we call the tablet, emerged. And then by 2013, we have just a world of smartphones and devices and literally well over a million applications that are out in the marketplace. And what's happening now in this aspect of changing consumer behavior, if you talk to any retailer right now, and I was just recently with Tom's and ModCloth and Mondique and Sephora at an event just not so long ago, Unilever, major manufacturers, Coca-Cola, and 201, they're all recognizing that their mobile traffic has exceeded that tipping point of 50%. Many brands now, in fact, John Lewis from the UK had pointed out the other day that during Christmas time last year, 75% of all of their web traffic was coming from a mobile device. And Argos, another UK retailer, noted by 2015, they believe that 100% of their commerce will be influenced by mobile. And why this is important to know is there's just a tremendous amount of insight and data. And if we're thinking about, we hear all the numbers, but seeing is believing. If we take a step forward, we can now look, when we elected the Pope this year, or last year in 2013, now look at the screen. Everybody has these supercomputer computing devices in their hands, and they're using them to consume media, to be entertained, to be to be informed, to express need at any point in time in the 24/7 mode. So, what we need to realize as marketers is what's happened with this evolution, what's happened with these changes in the computing platforms. Is 1990 and before, in the days of manufacturing and distribution supremacy, it was pretty easy to reach the customer. It was TV, print, radio, display, maybe faxes, telephones. And then as the information age emerged, what came with it was now a wealth of new media channels and opportunities to engage and interact with the consumer. And by 2012, 2 years after the data age, even more channels are opening up. And what's happening in this process now is this idea of one-to-one marketing, the ability to engage and interact with the consumer contextually relevant way, as conceived of by Don Peppers in 1996 in his book, The Future of One-to-One Marketing, example is now a reality. And if we want to look at where we're at with consumer behavior and we want to look at data today, we can now see that, and when we think about data and we think about engaging consumers, we can now see that well over 50% of consumer interaction is now digital, and all digital interaction is based on data. And this change has been happening quite quick. From 2009 to 2013, TV drops from 45% to 38% of consumers' media time spent, but mobile grows from 4% to 20%. And what's happening now in this process is that what we need to realize is that when we look at this idea about mobile and we understand this idea about mobile and digital engagement, we need to recognize the fact that mobile and digital interaction is our websites, and more and more consumers are engaging and interacting with brands through mobile devices than the traditional web. Now, recent studies have shown that emails are somewhere between the 60 to 75% of emails are all being initially opened up on a mobile device. And other follow-on statistics show that 90% of all emails are read on a single device. So what this is telling you is that we need to use this information, we need to use this data to optimize our experiences for the mobile device and optimize our experiences for where the consumer is going. Furthering it, and so when we think about then, as consumers have been adopting these digital platforms, these interactions, as they see these wealth of new media channels, emerging, we need to recognize that consumer expectations are changing. Not only has their behavior been changing, that we're using these mobile devices, we're using these wearable computers to interact with media, to interact with the world in new and exciting ways, but our expectations of what that interaction is changing dramatically. Now, unfortunately, the video is not going to play, and I'll be happy to send this to you if you shoot me an email. Again, it's michael.becker@somoglobal.com. You can see the differences in expectations. So, for instance, increasingly we're reading more and more of our books and our magazines and media on these mobile devices. And there was a really great ad that was done the other day by an insurance company where as the consumer's flipping through this iPad and changing the screen, you know, as they try to turn the page, a car comes racing across the screen and crashes into the side of the iPad. And it's an ad for an insurance company that basically says, you never know what's going to happen. This kind of interactive, rich media expectation is increasingly the norm now in the marketplace. Similarly, here's another illustration or example of an award-winning program for Audi, where consumers now are not expecting just to see a traditional flat media ad. They can pull out an Audi guide, scan that printed catalog, and then be immersed into an interactive augmented reality experience where they can actually turn the iPad around. They can click on any of the items in this visual view of the car. And, in fact, if they actually turn the iPad and then looked over their shoulder, they could actually be immersed in a 360-degree view of what it was like to be in that car. Now, so what we're seeing now is media experiences are becoming more rich and dynamic. Consumers are becoming now immersed with not just in the media but the experience of the product. Other expectations that are changing in the marketplace, too, is that, for instance, Google is testing in the San Francisco Bay Area the ability to do shipping in a single day. So I was sitting with my daughter reading a book the other day, and she asked me, you know, hey, Dad, can you get that tape for that new label printer you got me the other day? I ran out. I said, sure. So I pulled up my Google Express application. I bought the tape, and literally within 2 hours, it was sitting there at my front door, no shipping cost. So this idea that, you know, Google knows where I am, the application knows where I am, all of the data about these goods and services and what's relevant to me is flowing into these products, and then the fact that I could buy it and have it show up my door within 2 hours is a really interesting expectation that's being increasingly happening in the marketplace. But what we need to realize when we think about the role of data and marketing and the changing aspects of the industry, it's not just about these digital experiences as well. So what you're looking at here in this picture is a picture of the Amazon River. And there's a really interesting natural phenomena that happens in the marketplace, in the Amazon River. In the river on the right, this kind of coffee latte-colored river, that is the Amazon itself. And it's filled with this clay and various dirt coming up out of the mountain. The black river on the left is the Rio Negro, and this is filled with all the dark organic material that's coming up out of the jungle. And when the two rivers meet, what's fascinating about this natural experience is when the two rivers meet, they don't actually merge. So they actually coexist in the same riverbed for nearly 4 miles. And this is really an important illustration to think about because the reason why they don't merge is they have different speeds, temperatures, and densities. And so when we think about marketing today and we think about this evolution of marketing, we need to realize that marketing is going through the same change. On one side, we have this thing called digital marketing, and we have this experience of data and all of these ways we can interact with the consumer. On the other side, we have this thing called traditional marketing. And because their properties are different, because how we measure them, because how we look at the data is different, they're not, in fact, merging. And so marketing as a process is, you know, overlooking both of these activities, digital and traditional marketing. But marketers are really, you know, they don't understand what's going on. They don't have a thorough 360-degree view of their consumer. And, in fact, there was a study done by Adobe about 4 months ago that recognized that nearly only 9% of digital marketers actually trust that their digital marketing is working. And 83% of these marketers have not been formally trained in digital marketing and in the data and how to make it work. And so what's fascinating about where we are in the marketplace today and the role of data in the marketplace and the role of where marketing is going is this concept called mobile marketing. In fact, we can just drop the word mobile and just call it marketing nowadays. Because what we're realizing is that mobile and mobile devices in this world of connectivity is that connective tissue that's binding the digital and traditional world together. So let's illustrate those examples a little bit. So, for instance, if there's any Breaking Bad fans out there, or excuse me, Walking Dead fans out there, Breaking Bad did it as well. AMC enabled this syncing between stories. So while I'm watching my television, I could have my iPad and actually be responding to polls and interacting with the community in prime time while watching TV. So, again, here's another expectation that's been raised by the consumer. Another example of merging traditional and physical media, and, again, I have a video for this one as well if people are interested, is this example for a Granada pet food. And so, essentially, people would be walking their pet by this billboard. Traditionally, they see the billboard, great, that's interesting. But what they did, and if you look down at the bottom right corner, the call to action here is check in, or the call to action on the billboard is check in, check out. So what they're inviting the consumer to do is check into the billboard with Foursquare, and if you look at the bottom of the billboard, there's a little pet food dish there. And the second the owner checks in, pet food comes out of the billboard, and the dog gets to snack the pet food and try it. So here's a great example of what's going on between interacting traditional media and digital media, so the digital media being the Foursquare check-in, the traditional media being the billboard itself. And there's just a tremendous amount of behavioral data that can come from this. One, the level, the amount of snacking, who was there, when they were there, et cetera. But we're also seeing digital emerge itself into supermarkets. So, for instance, here's an interesting solution from a company called Touché, who is now with Unilever, Walgreens, and other leading retailers, is actually integrating digital displays right into the retail environment. And again, consumers now can interact, they can trial, they can experience this merging of between the digital and traditional media environments. But again, it's not just about doing traditional examples like these. You're also going to see utility examples where companies like Walgreens are taking data and they're integrating that data right into, say, my prescription reminder. So they know when I filled my prescription last. They'll remind me when I need to fill my prescription. They're linking my prescription with the UPC codes on the bottle so I can scan my code, and then Walgreens will text me to let me know when it needs to be done. These are all, again, changes in the rising stages of consumer expectation when it comes to this merging of digital and physical world. You're also seeing, too, for instance, another example of bringing customer care into the role. So Amazon, with their new launch of their new tablet, has actually integrated what they call the Mayday button. And so I can actually have real-time, in-line customer care with a real person right on the tablet. Again, this digitization and merging between the physical and digital world. All really, really important when we think about the changing behavior and changing expectations of consumer data. But it's not just about the tablets and the phones or the physical experience. It's about this idea of what we call the Internet of Things, where everything is being connected. And by 2020, the expectation is that there will be 50 billion connected devices in the world. There will be 13 quadrillion. These 50 billion devices will generate 13 quadrillion connections to the Internet. That's 15 zeros. And when we look at these devices, what are they doing? What kind of devices are they? You have, for instance, the phones that we've already been talking about. You have these new emerging categories of devices called augmented reality. Google Glass is one of the first commercial examples of that, where I can use augmented reality not to immerse the consumer in the experience like the Audi iPad example, but the reverse of that, where I can actually superimpose information and insight over the world by looking through the lenses of the glasses. And there's predictions in the marketplace that this idea of augmented reality as part of the mobile and digital media sphere will create by 2019 will create over 19 billion new media impressions that never existed before. In fact, because of mobile, because of digital, because of what we're seeing in the marketplace, every surface now can become an opportunity for marketing engagement because every surface can now become interactive. What you're also going to see as well, we have augmented refrigerators and cameras. Our contact lenses are now becoming digitally enabled, and we can, for health monitoring, for instance, they can monitor the pressure in our eyes for glaucoma and related health issues. Our pills are becoming digitally enabled. I can swallow my pill. The pill can talk to the Band-Aid. The Band-Aid can talk to the phone, and the phone can now talk to the doctor. So now we can understand the efficacy of when pills have been taken and how they're doing in the body. You're finding that people are integrating RFID tags in their body so that I'm actually going to embed in identity and embed codes and data into myself, so I don't need to be carrying them around. Think about it as an embedded USB key. We can be tattooing data triggers on our body with Motorola digital tattoos. There are new incarnations of smartwatches and other health meters, NFC-enabled rings, so you don't need cars and keychains anymore. I can put my NFC-enabled ring on, and then when I go open up the car door, my identity will be immediately communicated to the car, unlock the car, and enable the car to turn on. And this is just the tip of the iceberg of what's going on in the marketplace. By 2020, it's expected that the average person on the planet will have 7.4 connected devices in their life and what it means to data. And then one more point is that Ford just this last year released the Ford Open XC platform, which is essentially they've opened up 30 unique data points into the performance of the Ford car. So when we're talking about data and we're looking at the broad scope of where data is going, this is what we're talking about, data, this world of Internet things, the world of connected devices, and the unsurpassed amount of data in the marketplace. And in fact, by 2020, the expectation is that 40,000 exabytes of data will be generated. Right now, the expectation, all human words ever conveyed is about 5 exabytes of data. According to Eric Schmidt from Google, we make as much data every 2 years as we did in all of human history up to 2003. So it's just a massive amount of data what's going on in the marketplace. And so when we look at that, let's look at data 6Ds, and we realize, and according to the World Economic Forum, we recognize that, in fact, data is the new black oil. As we talked about from the Forrester research before as well, data is the basis of competition going forward. And there are 6 elements of data that we need to look at: the volume of data, the variety of data, the velocity of data, how quickly it's coming in, the veracity or accuracy of that data, the ability to visualize the data, and the value of the data are all the key elements that you need to be thinking about when you're engaging and interacting with data in this new digitally connected world. And really, really important for us to be thinking about it. So with this context in mind and understanding the transition of marketing, understanding the role of mobility and connectivity within the marketplace and the value of data and where it's going, let's look at the marketing orchestra and recognize that the CMO, it has a new role. The CMO is now the conductor of business, because with this changing expectation of the consumer, we have this emerging concept called the omnichannel, which is the customer's view of the brand. And then the execution side of the marketplace, which is the multi-channel or cross-channel experience. So the omni-channel refers to the brand's collection of experiences throughout every channel. So data binds these experiences together, and you as a marketer need to understand how to administer it, manipulate it, so that you can provide the consumer with this omni-channel experience. And the reason why we use this kind of orchestra analogy when we're talking about marketers' new role and the CMO is that the CMO's job to create the harmony. If just like you were sitting in the audience of an orchestra, you want to see harmony amongst all the instruments in the orchestra. It's now the CMO's job to create harmony across all of those channels we showed you before, leveraging all of these capabilities, both traditional and digital, to engage and interact with the consumer. And many brands are starting to realize that. So, for example, in January of 2013, Macy's appointed Robert Harrison as the chief omnichannel officer. This recognition that they're going to have a head executive looking at how do we create consistent experience across the entire business for our customers. Then you have this idea called the multi-channel. Now, this is the brand's view of that omnichannel experience. And in a multi-channel experience, what's going on there is it's the marketer's role of being able to coordinate it seamlessly all of the various interactive tools that are available to them. And from the mobile perspective within that orchestra, you have a lot. The mobile section of the orchestra includes all of this mobile advertising, mobile presence, mobile messaging, mobile alerts and triggers, mobile payment capabilities, and then enablement tools like augmented reality, location, loyalty, social, your analytics and data services and search that influence all of those other instruments. So think about those as the unique little tuners within every other instrument within the mobile orchestra. And so what marketers are needing to realize and recognize is that in this data age, that there's behavioral change in the quantified self, i.e., my monitoring of my health, et cetera, my multi-screen experience, the expectation of contextual relevance with every engagement, is critical in developing this new concept of what my partner and I and what we often talk about in the marketplace is this idea of directed shopping, that marketers now can engage and interact with the consumer in a unique and relevant way and direct them through the experience, navigate them through the experience. And this is the new approach for marketing. We need to go from the old world marketing of product focus to the new world marketing of customer focus. And in that process, when we go from that process, we have the old approach of not product profitability, but now customer profitability, not customer sales, but now customer lifetime value, et cetera. And again, brands are recognizing this. Marriott, in just this last November, has the CIO, the Chief Information Officer, now reporting to the CMO. Again, leading brands are realizing this significant change is happening in the experience that they're providing, and they're focusing on this role of directed shopping, not in Marriott, and Marriott's doing it in particular, but other brands are as well. So, for example, there's a company called Pointer up in Seattle that has created a new way of doing retail, leveraging and interacting with data by just simply putting up one example of a pair of pants. You scan the code then interacts with the application. They have all of my profile information, and they can help me size, find the right sizes, but also help me combine and mix and match other clothing to have a really great experience. This would only happen with data. Down in South America, Hellman used this incredible data-driven interactive experience where consumers would take data-enabled grocery charts that were linking to the various products that were on the shelves in the chart. And so, on the shelves. So as people are walking through this grocery store with their data-enabled shopping cart, the shopping cart would talk to the sandwich meat on the aisle, and then suggest new ways with the interactive display on the cart on how shoppers could be using Hellman's spread to get more and more value than simply using it for sandwiches. And this interaction, this merger between physical and digital media for Hellman's and a one-month trial down in South America, it created 45,000 unique new interactions and increased sales by 68%. This is what it means to be enabled to engage and interact with data and when you're in an environment. And there's another wonderful video that I'll conclude with this, is that there's a great campaign that was done down in Latin America called Hijack. And what this company was able to do, leveraging and using data, is as consumers were walking around the mall, if that consumer, a consumer that was part of their loyalty program walked into a competitor's store, that consumer would immediately get an alert. Their discount for a pair of shoes would start at 100%, and for every second that went by, their discount would decrease by 1%. And so what the video was showing, what you show in the campaign, is that people would race out of the competitor store, run through the mall, run into the meatpacks shoe store, and get that discount on the shoe. And there was one example where one gentleman ran through the mall so quickly they got an 89% discount on shoes. Another great use of data. In this case, I'm knowing where my customers are, knowing that my customers are in a competitive store, hijacking that customer and getting them over to my store. So in order to make all of this happen and everything that we've been talking about, what you need to realize and think about is within this marketer's new symphony, it takes an ensemble to make it happen. You know, and your success will rely on developing your right capabilities, your right people, your right partners, your right processes, and your right technology. And so with that in mind, what I'd like to now do is hand this over to Mary Jo, and she can show with you how do you source this data, how you source this data properly, and bring it into your marketing plan to be able to, you know, create the experiences that we just talked about in the beginning of this presentation. So, Mary Jo, you want to take it away?
I will do it. Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate it. And you're going to be a hard act to follow because everything you said was so interesting. It was fun to follow along with you. So we talked about a lot of things, or Michael talked about a lot of things in terms of, you know, mobility, where data is, and that really leads us into the total data landscape. And there's a lot of things to think about in the data landscape. Where is data accessed? Where is it available? In terms of where you are with the data, being able to recognize you, so in order to push data or make it available or be able to react to you, the client or potential customer, in the right way, we have to have some recognition. So, and in order to do that, we have to have data and technology. And then when we look at the overall big picture, we have the client expectations that Michael talked about. And today we want everything bigger, faster, better, cheaper, and more in line with what my expectations are or who I am. So when we look at the data landscape and we say, we look at the online availability, you know, when we have clients or potential clients landing on our websites, we all know that we have platform statistics. We can, through cookies and recognition, we can display the correct ad activity to a client. We can get analytics on that. We can also work with affiliate ad networks that will basically push or create ads for us and bring clients to our websites. We can also look at geolocation data, which, you know, as you're on your mobile device, as in the very last example that Michael spoke about, you know, your mobile, if you allow it, your mobile app or your mobile device will let people know where you are. It will also allow you to do local searches if you want to go to a restaurant near to where you are at a point in time. And then if we look at purchasing activity, you know, being able to have that point of service purchasing history, you know, when I get online or when I go someplace, whether it be by my mobile device or even calling to somebody, I want to be able to be recognized. And in addition to that, you as the marketer or you as the retailer want to know who it is that you're connecting with so you can react appropriately to it. And then, of course, we have social media, different social profiles, and this type of information is available and can be integrated into the mix. And then we have call center interactions. So as we look at the purchasing activity and we look at how you might be contacted, we have the call center interaction and the ability to recognize, and again, we want the data and the technology to be able to recognize quickly and bring forward information about consumer interaction or partner interaction that you can use to interact with the client in the way that they want to be and more quickly. So if we look at all of this information together or all of these pieces together is where data compilers or third-party providers will come into play. And companies like myself, which is Infutor, and I'm sure you're all familiar with several of the companies that are available to put this information together, use all of these pieces of information along with technology to help you access and interact with your client or potential client. So if we just take a couple minutes to think about data sourcing and where all of this data comes from and how would third-party providers typically source the data, along the left-hand side, I've listed some of the usual suspects that is available for us to be able to put data together. And it's really all about the completeness of the data that we'll get in addition to the timeliness of the data. So that as you as a consumer or one of your clients come into any one of the access points that we've talked about, we can know who you are, what you need, what you've done in the past. So, of course, you know, many of us have daily feeds from directory assistance, so we can recognize you as a phone number or your phone number when you as you make that access. And if we look at this person in the middle here that we'll call John Smith, and we can look at the circle of pieces of information as they come together, and all of these pieces of information that would go into the data sourcing will help us with that recognition. So, for instance, we talked about directory assistance. There's also information on mobile phones that many of the companies will have. And when people are accessing you from their mobile device, we all know that wireless phone data is not publicly available in that type of arena, so we need to be able to have that type of information available. When we look at different aliases that John has, perhaps when John was in college, he went as J.R. Smith, and now that he's grown up and you know, using his credit cards to or in more of a business mode, using his credit cards to make his purchases, he now uses the name John Smith. So those are various aliases, and we need to be able to have those recognition points of being able to tie all of these pieces of information to know that we're actually looking at Jonathan R. Smith. I don't want to take you tediously through each one of these data points, but as you, it's important to know that, for instance, when you land on a website and somebody recognizes you, they see your IP address along with your email address. And so those pieces of information actually can be combined together to create a cookie. As you go through life, and one of the examples that I like to give is that my name is Mary Jo Yafchuk. I used to be, prior to that time, I was Mary Jo Spacer, and I lived in Wisconsin. I live in Florida now. But I have had ongoing relationships with various of the retailers that I do business with, and I have longstanding relationships with them. And so it's important to me when I am in touch with them and that I am looking for information or I dial in that they can recognize me. And so what is really important as we're putting data together or sourcing data is that persistent ID that will tie various of my aliases together. So if you look at this example, John Smith maybe now lives at 126 North Main Street, but maybe when he was JR and in college, he lived at 1900 Michigan Avenue, but he's still the same person. And that piece of information or the ability to tie those many pieces of information are very important, especially when we look then at tying to either the mobile phone, the email address, a cookie, IP address, and other information about me that would help me to make a decision on something I might be interested in purchasing, that we can tie all those pieces of information together, and we can do it quickly. So instant recognition, all of the data pieces to put it together, and the technology to make it happen quickly. So some of the things that you might want to be cognizant of when you're working with third-party data providers is quality checklists. And we as data providers have a responsibility to build things the right way, make sure that they're cleansed properly. There's a variety of steps here that we go through. One of the things that I just want to point out is basically looking at the pieces of data themselves and making sure that they are what they say they are. There's a recent example that was in many of the online communications that we saw lately that the Office Max company had actually sent out a mail piece where the first name on the mail piece was daughter killed in car accident. And so when we look at, and of course they had purchased this data from a third party provider, but when you look at the discomfort and the pain inflicted upon the family and what you'd want to have available to your own company as you're delivering data is the accuracy. And so going through these different steps of, while they may sound some tedious and mundane, they're very important when you're tying pieces of information together that accidents like this cannot happen. Then we have, and I'm not going to spend too much time on the various data regulations, but all of us have to be aware of the data regulations that are out there in terms of how we can use phone data appropriately. You know, having a SAN number if you're going to be scrubbing DNC phones. The DPPA many years ago made it unlawful for us to use registration data or auto registration data to use for marketing. So we need to be cognizant of those types of things and knowing that that type of information isn't used to put data together. In the email side, we have CAN-SPAM compliance. So basically when we look at CAN-SPAM, the bottom line is be who you say you are. Don't say you can do something that you can't. You know, allow people to opt out and honor those requests and have a way for others to be able to contact you when they need to be able to opt out of various of these offers. And then in addition to just the data sourcing and security, looking at how the data is protected itself, because we hear a lot now, you know, when we're talking about all of these different contact points, we're talking about all of these pieces of data that are available. And we talk about, you know, consumers are continually concerned about privacy, and we see this even just in the last week or so. We saw that Rockefeller has, one of the senators has introduced even more legislation that would confine we as marketers even more. We want to make sure that we are storing data in such a way that we protect people's privacy, the facilities have SSAE 16 certification or follow those requirements, and that we're making sure that the data we have is legally obtained and that it's the kind of data that we can use in a public forum. So I thought one of the things that would be more interesting than talking about how the data is created is how we can actually use the data. And our first example here is, I think, a great example in terms of something that sounds boring, but something that is so important, which is duplicate identification. We talked a little bit earlier about the various data points and persistent IDs, and that's the difference in a database like that of a referential file versus a marketing database, which is a flash point in time. And so being able to bring those multiple aliases together, points of contact, different addresses, this is an example of where in a particular case, an agency that we worked with needed to just increase recognition by 0.7% in a merge-purge outcome to be able to help a client that they were spending way too much money on not only direct mail that they were doing, but in trying to reach audience or potential audience, and they were sending out information or trying to contact people that were really one in the same. This is a huge improvement for this particular audience, and it made a huge difference in their budget. Just a side example to that is, you know, at Christmas time, I had a similar example happen to me myself where I received a catalog. I actually received three catalogs with three variations of my Mary Jo Yafchuk name and my Mary Jo Stacer name combined with my address where I am located now. But it's a 24-page catalog that I received three copies of twice because there was two versions of it that went out that would make a huge difference to the marketer and how they would go about communicating with me and sending me the right information and not, you know, using up budget that isn't necessary or actually wasting money. And the second example, donor identification, this really speaks to being able to recognize somebody right when they're connected to you. And while this particular example is for a very large major nonprofit, this same example would apply when we look at the retail experience or any type of customer experience. And what this particular donor did was use in real time. So now we're talking about recognition. Somebody would call. We would see from their call center, we could instantly recognize who this donor was. We were able to give the call center information immediately on what kind of donor they were, because in this particular case, It was very important for the nonprofit to treat especially their highest level donors in a very special and respectful way. Of course, all their donors would be treated respectfully, but they wanted to make sure that those donors were recognized in a very special way, and even changed the way in which those particular donors, as they called in through real-time technology and recognition, and funneled them to the most appropriate operator on the nonprofit side as they were able to. And so I know we're coming to an end here. I have a couple more examples. Anybody, I think that this is available to anybody that wants to see it. So if anybody would like to contact me or ask me questions about any of these other examples, I'm happy to help you with that and talk to you about it. How the big picture really, though, is all of the data that's accumulated, the ability to use recognition instantly to react to that client or potential client when they approach you. And I think we can move on to the Q&A.
Great. Thank you so much, Manager. That was great. I think both presenters offered some great information to our listeners today. And, yes, Manager, all of the listeners today will be getting a copy of the presentation. And we'll remind everyone at the end of the Q&A of everybody's email addresses if they have more specific questions. But we do have a few questions that came over, and we have a couple of more minutes here if anybody would like to send some more questions. But I'm just going to start out from the sort of first question and then go upwards. So, and this is kind of a basic one, but I think it might be useful for the audience. Michael, what was the name of the author in the book that you discussed? It was about data swirling.
It's called Trillions, T-I-R-L-L-I-O-N-S.
And what was the author's name?
Nikki McManus. He's the second author of the book, but it's wonderful. Lucas and Bailey were the other two authors. But absolutely wonderful book.
Okay, great. Thank you. That is an easy one. So this one could be for either, but maybe, Michael, you could start, and then Mary Jo, maybe you could chime in. This is a question about buying ads on mobile devices. And the listener was wondering about sort of what is the obviously when you buy ads on mobile devices, you're going to probably buy local, since most mobile ads are sort of, you know, based on where someone is at the particular moment. But if a company is selling nationwide, what's the benefit to doing mobile advertising? I mean, isn't it just really a local buy?
That's a huge question, and the answer is it depends. And it's depending on your brand and the type of product you have. But, you know, for example, this is somewhat of an older study, but there was a great campaign done by Halls where they wanted to feature – so Halls, the cough drops, that's obviously a nationally sold product. But what they did is they used hyper-local advertising, and they over-indexed the advertising in those areas where the CDC had mentioned that there's high levels of flu. And so they were in comparing that hyper-targeted advertising in the areas where people had flu for this nationwide product versus those that were in areas that weren't indexed to flu, there was a 62.5% increase in engagement. So there's a great example of a national product being hyper-targeted to local engagement. Likewise, you'll see products like CoverGirl or the L'Oreal brand. Who will work very tightly with their distributors, say, like Nordstrom. So they may be advertising the product, but then part of the experience is, here's the local store that you can buy it. And there's other technologies out there that not only let you know where it can be bought, but they can let you know if it's available on the shelf right now. And then you'll also find other examples of leveraging this type of engagement to combat showrooming within the retail store. So there's just tremendous value for the effective use of mobile advertising in this context.
Would it, Mary Jo, did you want to talk about that at all, or is that really Michael's?
No, just one side note. You know, one of the things that you'll see as you walk into retail establishments sometimes is text 12345 to get more information about a particular piece of good or to be able to relate to it or to be able to get more information on it. And when that happens, it's more of a local type of interaction. But when somebody texts that, in mobile marketing, you're not really allowed to text somebody or contact somebody on their mobile phone unless they give you permission to. However, when they text 12345, to get more information on a particular thing, you can use a data company to help you identify who that person was so that you can use that information to be able to recognize them again in the future and possibly do other marketing to them.
Oh, great. A great tip. This listener was interested in going in sort of the part of the discussions and where we're talking about tracking customers with IP addresses and emails. I'm not sure if this is necessarily a mobile question, but maybe either of you can offer some insight there. For example, when a customer goes back to a website, hovers over an offer, for example, and then logs in, can that be tracked?
Yeah, and so I'll jump in and grab that one real quick. So there's a lot of tracking going on in the marketplace, and on the digital side, i.e. traditional web, you have the Digital Advertising Alliance from a tracking and retargeting aspect that helps you understand how you track and monitor in a compliant way the behavior of somebody's activity on the web. And there's ways to do that in an appropriate way. Likewise, the Privacy Forum has just recently come out with some standards about how you do that for tracking people in store in a compliant and effective way, leveraging MAC addresses and such. But there's a lot of really other interesting technology that's emerging, like Beacon. So SOMO, the agency that I'm representing, has some incredible insights into how you can be integrating beacons to your store. And beacons have been recently popularized by Apple with the release of what's referred to as the iBeacon, which is essentially their version of this. But beacons are really tied to the new Bluetooth standard that can be what's called Bluetooth Low Energy that can be used for triggering hyper-targeted proximity alerts. And I was talking with someone from the NFL the other day, and they had mentioned that their experiments in beacons are such that if you're 10 feet away from the beacon access point, they can add with the high levels of targeting, they can actually determine, are you the third person or the sixth person in line? And then you can then convey and deliver a unique message to that individual. But one point with all of this, when it comes to tracking, targeting, et cetera, is to really focus on the fundamental principles of privacy by design. And those include choice, notice, control, and security. And Mary Jo had mentioned, referred to another, many of those. But what you also want to be doing is making sure that your databases are structured such that your databases are actually recognized for privacy by design as well. Because a lot of these technologies, like beacons, for instance, can capture MAC addresses or IP addresses, but many leading brands are consciously not storing that data to ensure that their compliance, their data standards are tied with their corporate compliance and their security. So it's a great example of just because you can doesn't mean you should. So when you're implementing and you're talking to a partner like Mary Jo's firm, you need to really think about not just what data I can use, but how I can use it and how I store it, et cetera.
Mary Jo, did you want to add something there?
I completely agree in terms of the actual IP address. Would we give that out to somebody? No, we wouldn't. But what we do is we use that information, together with possibly an email address is whereby you can create a cookie so that there's some recognition when somebody lands there. But we wouldn't want to be offering up that kind of information and violating anybody's privacy.
Great. I think we're actually just about out of time for today. So, first of all, I'd like to thank Michael Becker and Mary Jo Yakshink for for your great presentation. And I also would like to say on behalf of Retail Online Integration and Infuture, thank you to everyone listening today for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And also, if you wouldn't mind taking a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen, we'll be grateful. And your feedback will help us to influence the webinars we bring you in the future, just as an FYI. And actually, finally, in closing, I just wanted to let you know that we have a new feature with our system here, and you can subscribe to our publication, Retail Online Integration, via the ROI widget for free. So please check that out before you head out for the day. And with that, I hope to see you all at the next Retail Online Integration webinar. Thanks so much, everybody. Bye-bye.